I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester. His name is John Anilio, and you're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast, episode number 204. And John, we still don't know as of this recording. So we're like 3 weeks out from the Hugos, and we still don't know whether or not I won a Hugo because we're recording it before the Hugos. It's the whole wibbly wobbly timey wimey thing that screws us up every time.
Yeah, you know, I was just thinking about that. It's like, you know, if people are listening to this right now, they're going to be like, oh, that poor bastard doesn't know what he lost. Oh, that's so sad. Oh, man. Oh, I thought it was his year. That is Patrick Hester. He's an author, blogger, and a podcast dude. Check out his website, atfmb.com. Follow him on Twitter, at atfmb. My name is John Anilio. I write songs and compose music, and you can check out my music over at
John. He writes songs that make...
I write very Barry Manilow-esque songs, and you can check that out over at johnanilio.com. Follow me on Twitter. at John Anilio. And our author today, one of our favorites, Chuck Wendig. He is the author of many published novels, including some from Angry Robot, like Blackbirds and Blue Blazes, and other novels like Under the Empyrean Sky and his new one, Blightboard. Chuck's main blog, which is, I think, you know, crucial reading if you're in this community, and that is terribleminds.com. You can follow him on Twitter at Chuck Wendig. Chuck, thanks for joining us today.
Hello, nerds. How are
you guys? Chuck, I want to officially thank you.
Oh, you're welcome for whatever it is that I did.
On your how to behave at cons and on panels post on terribleminds.com.
I shouted you out.
You did, and I appreciate that. That was very kind of you. Yeah. Thank you.
You are a top-shelf moderator.
Thank you.
You're cool. Good with me. That's you.
You know, when Chuck just said the "Hey Nerds" thing, it reminded me of when I saw Paul and Storm. I don't think they always say this, but that time I opened for Paul and Storm, the first thing they said when they walked out there, they were like, "Nerds, prepare to be pandered to." and it was so true and appropriate, but very funny. So, and it's funny. I've been watching At Midnight. Which is the show with Chris Hardwick, which my wife and I watch most nights, Paul and Storm were on that show, and my wife was like, "Is it weird seeing these guys? Because you kind of met them in person." I'm like, "It's a little weird seeing somebody that you know, like on TV. It's a little something."
Across the dimension.
It is a little weird, but so anyway, well, Chuck, you know, that brings us. I don't know if we're allowed to talk about it because I know you blogged about it a while back, but you have some TV stuff going on, do you?
Yes. Not?
Maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit about that.
Maybe. No. The fine people at Starz, the cable network, have optioned the Mary and Black series, starting with Blackbird. So they are. By the news reporting on a fast track to pick up, but of course it's Hollywood, so everything is yes before it's no. So I'm always waiting for the floor to completely drop out on us. But so far, so good.
Well, and it's interesting because I just saw today that Outlander, which is on Starz, is already picked up for a second season. So that is doing well.
Yeah.
So that is pretty good timing in some ways because that is a fantasy series with a female lead and
Neil Gaiman's what do they have there? American Gods, right?
Mm-hmm. I think so. Yeah, so it's look like they're really putting a lot of money into the literary stuff, and well, hopefully you guys will see the light of day. That would be pretty awesome.
So fingers crossed.
So Chuck, what's the process there? I mean, do you get a phone call from somebody? Do they even talk to you, or do you just like see it on the interwebs like everybody else?
No, they I you know, they do talk to me. I'm a consultant, quote unquote, on the show. I've seen the pilot script and seen some of the image books. I know I cannot repeat, but I know some of the casting hopes they have for the series. Mm-hmm. So it's very exciting. There's some really interesting creative people behind the show. I mean, people who worked on Breaking Bad, people who worked on X-Files, Big Love on HBO. I mean, it's a big... There's some really cool people.
Well, I'm glad that it's Stars and not like the History Channel or something, you know, yeah, weird like that.
Yeah, the History Channel. Yeah. Though History, of course, is under no obligation to show anything vaguely historical now. So.
Right, but, you know, I mean, imagine getting the call. It's like, hey, the History Channel wants to make your book, and they've decided to change it up a little bit to make it a vehicle for Giorgio. From Ancient Aliens. Sold. Yeah.
Yeah, bring it on.
Cool. Now, the most recent book that you have out, Blightborn, is the second part in a series. So, make tell people a little bit about that series of books and why they should go buy it.
Yeah, they should buy it just because they like me. And
the Heartland Trilogy.
Mm-hmm. Heartland Trilogy, yeah. Young Adult Trilogy, I call it my Corn Punk Trilogy, instead of a dystopia, sort of a dusttopia, because it's kind of a 1930s Dust Bowl aesthetic, but cast into a far-flung future where bloodthirsty corn has taken over everything at the behest of very rich people who live in the skies, who use that corn to fuel their giant skyships and sky cities. The hardscrabble fools who work in the corn below, of course, the young teen anarchist punks are the ones who are going to try to take down the evil empire above their heads. And Blightborn is the second book in that series, which sort of takes us out of the corn. Not only does it take us further afield in the heartland, and not only do we see glimpses of what lies beyond the heartland, but we also go and spend a considerable amount of the book on the flotillas, one of the quote-unquote floating cities. So that was kind of a cool thing to get to hang out with the one percenters, the Empyrean of that series.
Sweet. Now, with this book, you know, it's now the Heartland Trilogy is published through it's through Amazon, right?
Yeah, well, it's called Skyscape. They used to be Marshall Cavendish, and they are used to be Amazon's children publishing. They've been like three different things.
Now, are these all physical books too, or is this just ebook?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, physical books as well, if you choose to procure them.
There is a Kindle, a hardcover, and a paperback edition.
Yeah. The interesting thing about Blightborn is they chose to release the hardcover and paperback. Well, and Kindle, obviously, at the same time.
That's I don't know if I've ever heard of that happening.
Yeah, well, they're not really beholden to any bookstore releases. You know, they don't have any shelf competition.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, unfortunately, because it's Amazon, you don't actually, the books don't end up on a lot of bookstore shelves.
Yeah. So that's,
they do sometimes, but not in a big way.
I've read a lot of very positive reviews about it and a lot of good comments.
How about the books?
Yeah.
Yay.
How are they doing?
So far, so good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So far, so good. Fingers crossed they continue doing good. Doing well. as a nun appears up nowhere and cracks a ruler across my knuckles. Everything seems to be good. I'm looking forward to seeing how they do, you know, by the time the third book comes out next year.
Awesome. Awesome. Real good. All right. Well, let's move on to our picks of the week then.
Picks of the week.
Chuck, why don't you go first? Why don't you give us your pick this week?
Man, I think it's timed well because it's, I think it just came out too. I got an early copy of Robin Hobb's Fool's Assassin.
Mm.
And Robin Hobb, if you ever, in terms of fantasy, I do not know that there's anyone doing character work in a finer, more nuanced, incredibly grief-struck, tear your heart out and squish it, you know, onto the page sort of a thing. She's just a great, great author, profound fantasy. And so Fool's Assassin to carries on her the Fitz Chivalry character and the Fool character that she's been working with two other trilogies.
Yeah, there's been a lot of books on that one.
Yeah, this is the seventh now. There'll be nine total, I think, by the end of it.
Wow.
Yeah.
So is this the start of another trilogy then for that?
Yeah, it's like pretty far flung several decades after the last trilogy concluded. But it didn't take me long to sort of pick up the pace, man. It's awesome. It's good stuff.
Cool. Very good. Patrick, what is your pick this week?
So last week I picked the Guardians of the Galaxy soundtrack. This week I'm picking the movie. And I know we're a couple weeks out since it's been, you know, the number one movie in the world. But... I just loved it. I actually have seen it twice, both times in 3D, once on IMAX, just because I wanted to have that experience. And it was just an amazing movie. It's funny because the second time I saw it, I thought, well, now that I've seen it, if you know, I really, really have to go to the bathroom. I know the parts that are kind of slower and I can go. I never left. I just sat there.
No, there are no slow parts.
I watched it through the whole thing and I'm just like, ah, oh, this is such a great movie. I'm really impressed with it. I'm so happy with it because it could have went really, really wrong.
Yeah.
And it didn't. Now, the thing that did shock me is when I first saw it, we got out of the theater, Michelle and I, and we were just gushing about the movie. We loved the soundtrack. We loved the characters. We loved everything about it. And we went and I think got something to eat. And I sat down and I pulled up Facebook on my phone. And there was already an author complaining about the movie and saying that the characters weren't diverse enough. There weren't enough female characters. There weren't characters of color. And I'm going, well, there was a lot of pinks and greens and you know, so I'm not sure, but it almost clouded it because it's like they were already complaining about it.
It's tricky because I mean, it's true. And I think, you know, Marvel overall has sort of an issue with maybe how they treat, particularly female characters, but overall just sort of, they have maybe kind of a diversity. I don't want to say a problem.
They're,
but they're
getting
not.
So much better though.
Marvel is better than DC.
Yes.
Yeah. So I think it's vital to sort of grade these things. What, you know, a lot of people unfortunately look at things and it's pretty much black or white. It's yes or no. It's ones or a zero. But you do have to sort of grade these things. It's sort of like, well, okay, it's here. What's it like in this department? What's it like in this department? It's important to sort of, I think, find a nuanced way to talk about these things that isn't just a condemnation or isn't also just a celebration. It isn't just, well, it's perfect. Who cares about women? Or it didn't have the perfect, you know, female character, so it's doom. You've got to find that middle ground and be able to talk about this in a you know, critical way, especially as creators. And unfortunately, it's one of the things that takes the fun out of a lot of this stuff is creators sometimes look at these things from that sort of critical eye, and it's sometimes tricky to do.
Well, and you have a screenplay that was written by a woman.
Yes, though some reports say it was strongly rewritten by Gunn. Mm-hmm. I don't know how it works. But either way, she's obviously being celebrated. And my understanding, knowing some of the other creators I know some other screenwriters, and they seem to believe she had a pretty strong hand in it.
Anyway, I just thought it was a fantastic movie. It was so much fun.
It's great,
fun.
And it's fun. The movie's incredibly fun.
And
it's not at all grimdark.
And I'm wondering if this is going to change or inform or do anything about Disney's new J.J. Wars coming up.
I don't know. Episode 7 is definitely on notice.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm looking forward to that too. I think it's probably be a pretty different movie. I don't imagine it's going to be
fun. Here's
how I think Star Wars 7 should open. You know the classic thing with the Death Star coming over, you know, or the Star Destroyer coming over and shooting at the ship. I think that we should just see like a gigantic Death Star come and destroy the last ship full of Gungans.
And they all fall into space burning and then freezing.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the Luke Skywalker beard, have you guys seen that?
Yes.
Absolutely.
That's like a man. He just looks like such a grizzled old Jedi.
Oh, you like the beard? Yeah. You like the beard? Yeah.
I like the beard.
You like the beard, Chuck? Is that what you like? So I saw that picture and immediately I wanted to take it into Photoshop, mark him up with some white face paint and some red on his lips and say, "Why so serious?"
Nice, very good. All right, well, my pick this week, I've been reading a lot of these rock star autobiographies lately, and so I'm going to pick one that I've read recently, and that is Face the Music, A Life Exposed. That is by Paul Stanley from Kiss. And I am not really a big Kiss fan. I don't dislike Kiss. I had an album or two, and I listened to them occasionally, but I was compelled to read it, and it is quite a good read. More depth than you would expect, and you know they were in the news a lot the past, if you're kind of having an ear to music news, because they just got put into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and there was a lot of sort of controversy going back and forth because the Rock only wanted them to perform with Ace Frehley and Peter Criss, who were the original members. They refused, so they didn't perform at all, and they wanted other members put in. So there was a whole big back and forth, because I think the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame tends to be very kind of critic-driven, like music rock critic-driven. And so if you're sort of a favorite of the critics, then you get in no matter what. You get in early. And if you're not, like Kiss, I mean, Kiss was eligible probably like 15 years ago, and they just got put in. So a lot of those bands are getting put in now, but they're not critic favorites. So they sort of put all these stipulations on critics because even though I'm not a huge defender of Kiss, you know, they wanted other members of the band put in, members who were in longer than Ace Frehley and Peter Criss, and the Hall wouldn't allow, but the Grateful Dead got in with like 175 members, like members of the road crew and stuff got put in because the Dead was kind of a favorite of some critics. So it is kind of a double standard. But anyway, it's a really interesting story. A lot of stuff I didn't know about Paul Stanley. He was born without an ear, like one of his ears. It's a congenital condition where he was born deaf in his right ear, and his ear wasn't there. It just was like a stump of cartilage. So he was, you know, obviously kind of ridiculed as a kid because he was sort of monstrous looking. He had this, like, you know, stump of an ear. He couldn't hear. He did poorly in school because he could not make out what the teacher was saying, and led kind of a hard life as a youngster. And you know, but that's why, you know, he grew his hair long to cover up his ear, and that was his whole thing. So he's a real insecure guy, and eventually he ends up getting that sort of his ear fixed and all that. But it's a lot about his sort of personal struggles and all of that, and it's quite a he's the only author credited. I think there is another. There's a co-author though, but the co-author is not on the main cover. I think in the back they're like, and this guy helped me write it, which I think. Those guys, or those people, I should say, because I'm sure it's women a lot of times too, they do a great job because you do believe it's Paul Stanley writing it, but I'm sure it has a hell of a lot to do with the writer sort of structuring it and putting it together in a real readable,
authentic to his voice, right?
Yes. So it's if you like this kind of thing, like I said, I'm not even a Kiss fan, and I really enjoyed it. So yeah, Paul Stanley, A Face the Music, A Life Exposed. So I would go check.
And John,
he's a musician born without an ear.
Yeah.
And John,
I was a writer born without hands. I had no hands on this one. I had to grow them and build them out of parts.
Did you happen to see that Kiss bought a football team?
I did. I watched the first episode of their reality show.
There's
a reality show about it's on AMC. It's
hilarious.
It's Paul and Gene and Doc McGee, who's their manager, bought an arena league football team, and it's the LA Kiss, and it's sort of half them doing sort of owner stuff and then half on the field football stuff. I don't really watch a lot of reality shows, and I don't know if I'm going to keep watching this, but it's worth watching the first few minutes of an episode to see if you like it or not.
I actually did enjoy Gene Simmons' Family Jewels, which was on A&E, and I liked I particularly liked the last two seasons because they finally, you know, it's like they projected this family atmosphere for the entire run of the show, and then the last two seasons, Shannon just said, "This is it, I'm done, I don't want to do that anymore." Let's talk about all the women he sleeps with. To this day,
yeah. Well, that was in Paul Stanley's book, when he finally gets married, when he's an older gentleman. He was like 53 when he got married. Like, Gene was not invited to his wedding because Gene has always gone on record saying that, you know, oh, marriage is a joke, right, and it's a sham. And Paul was like, well, I don't really want you at my wedding where I think this is a beautiful, sacred thing. I don't really – like, we're still partners and business partners and friends for what we do, but I really don't want you here.
He did.
He did sleep with my wife.
Yeah, exactly.
He did finally marry Shannon.
Yes.
But they did this whole thing where they just, you know, he kept a storage locker with books of photographs of all the women he'd ever slept with.
Yeah.
All the groupies, everything. I mean, it was and that kind of stuff was like, holy crap, really?
Paul and Gene were not into drugs, but they were into the ladies. Mm. And there you go. That was Gene.
And I'll tell you what, if you've ever been to a convention with Chuck Wending.
Mm.
It's just like that.
Same thing.
Just like that.
Same thing.
Yep. Just how I roll. I roll with that.
All right. All right. So
Chuck's just shaking his head. He's like, you dumbass.
We're supposed to keep that undercover, Patrick. Yeah,
this is a
hear this, you're not supposed to say anything about that, man.
Just got this whole section. Just kind of right.
As I said earlier in the podcast, I think not that I'm really announcing earth-shaking news, but I think Chuck's blog is a must-read. I think he writes wonderfully, especially about stuff that goes on in genre and in publishing. And I'm sure Chuck's probably sick of talking and writing about a lot of this stuff. But one of the things that I really wanted to talk about with Chuck, because I think he brought up so many interesting points in it. And if you have not read Chuck's blogs, these are not dry, explorations of these topics. Chuck is always entertaining and funny, but very
clinically academic, sir. Clinically
yes.
academic.
but always very thought-provoking as well. And one of his most recent blogs was titled, "What is an ebook worth?"
Oh, yeah, that one.
And I really liked this one a lot because Chuck brings up so many great points in it. Because obviously this is kind of big news in our community now with the whole Amazon versus Hashtag thing. And then, you know, people trying to like, well, what is an ebook worth? And I think it should be worth this. And I think it should be worth this. And you know, essentially what I got out of reading Chuck's post is that there's so many factors that go into the value of really anything. That how can you say that there is one price point? So Chuck, you know, what sort of inspired that blog post then?
You know, anytime I get in the, I mean, obviously Amazon is basically saying, we think the sweet spot for an ebook is $9.99. That's the sweet spot. And they kind of have already done this with self-publishing authors, their KDP authors. They have a window there. $2.99 and $9.99 is the window. If you're outside that window, you only make 30-35% of your actual sale. But if you're in the window, you make 70%, right? So that's how they're trying to sort of wrangle you into that fence and keep you in that price point. So they believe that in terms of self-publishing. The story here with Amazon Hachette, I like Hatchet, I prefer to call them Hatchet, is they're kind of trying to get them into the same window. And if you're outside that window, they may give less money to the publisher. So you see kind of arguments bandying back and forth on these, you know, kind of religious sides of this fence, as if there's, you know, I don't know why we feel the need to be particularly obsequious to one corporate entity or another. They're just all big giant robots stepping on us. But a lot of what ends up being discussed is, you know, how you determine value and how you determine the worth, the cost of an ebook. And a lot of times people compare it to weird things. And I always just thought that was interesting. It's like, well, but $5 for a cup of coffee. Well, but, you know, Netflix is $8 for a whole month and I can watch stuff infinitely. Or, but a film is this and the book is this. And, you know, but for a 2 hours to watch a movie, but it takes me, you know, 2 weeks to read a book. And I was like, is any of that even valuable? And then, of course, part of the thing with an ebook is they start to say, well, but there's no printing costs, so if there's no printing costs, it's effectively worth nothing. And you're like, well, but that's horrible, isn't it? Because, I mean, didn't storytellers put a lot of energy into it? Don't publishers still, whether you're an author publisher or a self-publisher, or whether you're actually with a publishing company, isn't there still a great deal of effort being put into the creation of the story and the curation of the story and the design of the ebook and the marketing efforts? I mean, print is certainly a cost to consider, but it's not the end all be all. And it's certainly not how we price most things in reality anyway. I mean, a cup of coffee is not $5 in terms of the actual material that goes into the cup. We're used to a considerable amount of markup, but there's also a lot of things that go on before that. It's that whole Picasso story that it's like, you know, he draws a sketch on a napkin and says, I'm going to charge you $25,000 for it. They say, well, why? He says, it only took you 2 minutes to draw. And he says, well, it took me really a whole lifetime. So trying to figure out the value and the worth of an ebook is not easy. It's certainly not something I'm comfortable having Amazon or Hachette say it has to be this. Hachette gets, I think, the right to say what our ebooks are cost, you know, as Hachette's ebooks are cost. And I think different authors and different publishers should be allowed to make those decisions themselves. And if people don't want to pay for them, then that's sort of how the market goes.
Yeah, you, there are so many interesting things that you brought. I'm glad you brought up the Picasso line that you met, because that really hit home for me, because I've been teaching. I do these Skype music lessons these days, and I actually have a few songwriting and composition students that I've been teaching that way. And through doing that, even though I've been a teacher my whole adult life, I've never really taught this kind of thing to adults before. And it's interesting because it really brings up that point about, like, well, I've been working my whole life on this, and it's because as I'm trying to teach certain aspects of it, I realize, like, I can write a song pretty fast and of a pretty decent quality because I have 25 years or more of working on this, like listening to music and going to college and studying independently and writing 200 really shitty songs before I wrote a good one. And, you know, all of this stuff, playing in a million bands and learning how to do this and learning how to play these instruments, like all of this stuff that I don't think about because it was just stuff that I did that I wanted to do at the time. But when you, you know, you could put that to any author, every book that author has ever read, every English class that author has taken, every, you know, everything that goes into it, that certainly has value. So it's hard to put there. I think, you know, what you come to is that like no one outside of it should put it, you know, it's sort of market will kind of dictate. It's like whatever someone is willing to spend on it is what it's ultimately kind of worth.
Yeah. And what was interesting is a lot of the response to the blog post seemed to be from people trying to suggest what I was saying. They were trying to, oh, well, he's saying they should be cheap or they should be expensive. And I was like, I'm not really saying anything. Yeah. I'm not committing to a price. That's the whole point of the post is I'm not comfortable saying that, well, like $9.99 is good. You're game over. Like, we're done. We can just go home now. Like, that feels a little uncomfortable. Maybe it isn't. Maybe it's cheaper than that. Maybe that people don't want to pay $9.99. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But the point is, I think it's ebooks are really, in the grand scheme of things, a fairly nascent technology. We're still in baby steps territory. They're actually still kind of ugly. I mean, you can do nice ebooks, but generally they're not. Generally they're not designed very well. Generally they don't. The technology isn't. You know, we're still in early era of e-readers. Mm-hmm. So it's like let's let this shake out a little more before we start hammering things to the wall.
Yeah. This is obviously stuff I think about a lot in regards to music as well. And, you know, you mentioned Netflix in it. And I did like that one bit that you put about Netflix that, oh, it's infinite. You can watch anything you watch as long as it's 5% of the things that you might want to watch.
A lot of people made that. But Netflix is, I can watch anything I want on Netflix. Like, yeah, as long as what you want is on Netflix. Most things are not.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of good stuff on Netflix, but there's a lot that you want to watch that's not there. So it's not the be-all, end-all. It's one thing. But one thing I did watch on Netflix was, I believe it's called Downloaded. And it's all about Napster about that. So if these kinds of things are on your mind, that is definitely worth a watch about sort of the start of Napster and the fall of Napster and then... Yeah. And you know how the music, the record companies handled that so poorly, and how basically they could have, at least according to this doc and according to the guys that ran Napster, you know, their idea was that like after it became a thing where they got investors and all that, they realized like, well, we can't have a company based on other people's intellectual property, but this will be of value to the record companies because we're essentially building this infrastructure for them to have music streaming or music downloads, I should say. And the record companies could have been like, great, well, let's buy this technology and let's get the record companies could have owned all of that. They were so afraid of it that they sued, you know, Napster out of existence. And then there were a million other pirate sites that came up like the next week. And so it did nothing for them. And then Apple ended up being the one that really reaped a lot of those benefits with iTunes a few years later. But it's an interesting doc. And I think one that you'd probably like, Chuck, just based on the stuff that you've been talking about. But it's like, what is any of this worth? I mean, I use Spotify. I'm a musician. I pay for Spotify, but I don't like when people will sort of justify whatever their behavior is. Because I listen to so much music that something like Spotify was a godsend because I was never able to buy the amount of music that I wanted to listen to. I just don't have that kind of money. I just don't. So Spotify enables me to legally listen to as much music, pretty much as much music as I want. But I'm also very aware of the fact that artists are getting very little of those. They're getting something, so it's better than nothing. But a lot of the music I listen to, I know some of them, you know, they still put out physical copies, and some people still buy those physical copies. But there are so many revenue streams. I believe it was Jonathan Colton a few years back that they talked about, well, how much money do you make every time you put out a song? And I have to find the blog post. It was very interesting. He sort of put it as like sort of, I think the metaphor that he used, it was like, it's like a cow pooping money, that like the cow is going to eat all of these various different revenue streams, and eventually that'll poop out some money that I have, but I have no idea how I got any of that money out of it. You know, some of it's through licensing my music, some of it's through this and that and the other thing, but it's not like I sell 100,000 records and then I make a lot of money like they did in the old days, because that doesn't exist anymore.
Well, there was I have a writing partner on the film and TV side of things, and he wrote a column for a magazine at one point, and it was about film piracy. And so he interviewed a young, I think like 15-year-old film pirate, like big film pirate, like the kid, you know, this kid was very successful in Pirate Bay, and he did all that, he was very good at distributing pirate materials. So, you know, he kind of had to do this like secret spy, you know, way to get to the kid's house. And of course it's just a kid's house in the suburbs and his parents aren't home, because, you know, so he goes up to the kid's room and interviews him and talks about, you know, the kid basically looks at digital content almost as if it's like nothing. It's the air. It's just the cloud. You can just grab it. It's wispy. It's meaningless. It has no actual value to him. So he talks to the kid for a while. And at the end of the interview, he says, well, I'll send you the article, you know, so I'll give you a PDF of it. He's like, no. He's like, let me know when it goes on sale on newsstands. He's like, I'm going to go buy a bunch of copies. He's like, no, but I can actually just send you a digitized scan of it. He's like, since you're a pirate, he's like, it's not a problem. He's like, no, I want to buy it. He's like, if it's in physical, he's like, stuff I care about, and particularly if it's in a physical realm, I pay top dollar for that stuff. And of course, then you look around the kid's room, and it's like he's got all these, you know, rare comic books, and he's got posters all over his wall, stuff that this kid has paid a lot of money for. So it's an interesting, it doesn't say anything one way or the other, but it's just fascinating to see what people consider worth spending money on in terms of things that are, you know, created by other people. If it's, you know, online, it's almost viewed as like not real for this kid. But if it's physical and if it's something he cares about, he'll pay whatever he can pay to get it.
Well, and that brings up, you know, another article you wrote recently about promoting yourself as an author, as a creator. Oh, yeah. And one of the things that you said in that, and I remember even Cory Doctorow, I remember, said something about this a few years ago, that the way that it's going, and I think he was right, because I think this was really before it started happening, but his whole thing was the way to go in the future, that an author or creator, that author's fans will be more like friends. And you didn't mean necessarily like, oh, we're all going to hang out all the time, but they'll, you know, we're getting to the point, and I think we're kind of there in some ways, where because people can have fairly direct contact to people through Twitter or what have you, that the people that are often going to go out and buy your stuff are people that care about you as a person. And I think you talk a little bit about that in that article.
Yeah, it's, you know, I always say, instead of like, because a lot of the language goes toward how you build your audience, I always say it's more how you earn your audience. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason I don't like some of the corporate sort of chatter about creative people, like, you know, you're going to build your brand and you have to be on your platform. And I was like, platform sounds like I'm above these people. Mm-hmm. I think it's really, you know, I'm one of them. I'm in the audience with them. We're all sort of excited about a lot of different things. And, you know, if maybe sometimes they can be excited about some of the stuff I'm putting out there too. Hopefully I'm just part of it. And I think that's more interesting to be in communication with these people. I think it's hard to be an author or a creative person these days and not be in that kind of, mode of accessibility. I think you can do it. I don't think it's impossible. I just think it's one new way of sort of accessing those people and having them access you in return.
Yeah. I've come across this recently, and I think it's kind of a subtle thing that I've noticed in some creators that I like. I've been listening to this one podcast recently that interviews various musicians and rock and metal guys, and I've noticed a lot of the guys that I liked best, even before I listened to their interviews, they're people that are still big fans of what, you know, they never lost that feeling that they had when they first got into it. There was this one interview with this guy Eric Martin, who's the lead singer in Mr. Big, but he was in other bands too, and he was talking about how he did this show where he was recently opening for Y&T, which was, they had like a hit in the 80s, but they were like a big band in San Francisco, and he said, yeah, just the other night I opened for them, and as soon as I was done with my set, I went right into the audience of this small club right up front, and I sang every word to their song because I'm such a big fan of them. And I thought, like, that's cool. Like, that made me like that dude a lot more, because I just realized, like, yeah, he's still into it. Like,
yeah.
And I think people, whether it's subtle or not, people get that. And it's not, as you said, being on a platform above them. And I think people dig that.
Well, I think it's important why, you know, for creative people to talk about the other things that they're digging on. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Share and promote the work of other people. And like I said in the post, it's not because, like, you know, if I do this for you, you will do this for me. I'll get that from some people. They'll be like, well, I said about your book, so now it's time for you to promote mine. I was like, but I haven't read your book. Like,
will you blurb my book, Chuck? Will you blurb my book? Will you blurb my book? Will you blurb my book? Will you blurb my book?
Scrivener Bible. Patrick has your story. Yeah, it's like people say this to you. I'm like, but I haven't read it. Like, the people who follow me, ostensibly, if I'm saying these things, like, hey, this is awesome, I'm hoping it's because they trust my judgment, not because I'm a shill for someone whose book I haven't read, because I'm just doing some sort of scratch your back, you scratch mine kind of thing.
A couple years back at a Balticon, Matt Wallace, you know where this is going. You know, he just really encapsulated a lot of what you just said quite beautifully, and in a little more of a brusque way, I would say.
Matt? No. Yeah, no.
But, you know, he just said, he's like, oh, I hate all that, like, you know, sycophantic, like, authors jerking each other off bullshit. Like,
that's exactly what it is. It's, yeah.
Because it's like, look, I think ultimately, even what we're doing now are creative people sort of banding together to have ways of communicating with people so that they find out about cool stuff. So I realize there is a bit of hypocrisy in what I'm saying, but there are, you know, sometimes when I see that, when I can tell it's just like, oh, these five people got together and they're just like pimping the hell out of like their, and that's, but if that's all you do,
right,
then it just, I don't know. It always seems a little.
You can smell it.
I can. I can.
Fart in the car. You can just smell that. Yeah.
Absolutely. Whereas I feel like, again, I know people could maybe claim us as doing that, but I don't know. Chuck's been on the show a lot, and like a lot of other people have been on it. It's never.
So Chuck's
yeah. Out. Yeah. So I mean, I know a lot of people don't get like Patrick and being like, hey man, you're on the show, so phew. Got this new thing coming out that maybe you can, that's not really.
I actually do get that.
You get that?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, but you don't go to people all the time.
No.
Like, no, that's what I mean. No, I'm saying we don't do
it.
Oh,
yeah, yeah. No, no.
I have people on the show and then turn around and go like, hey,
No.
Got a lot of good publicity for that book, so how about you send a little bit? No, that's not how
Patrick
it works.
Patrick tries to get me wash his car, which I think is weird.
Yeah.
Shirtless
car washing. Well, that always brings
it. It was only the one time. It was only the one goddamn time.
No.
It was really hot out. Yeah. Well, anyway, okay. So, we're kind of running down on time. So, so Chuck, obviously, he has his website, terribleminds.com. He has his Twitter, at Chuck Wendig. The new book is Blightborn, which is out now. His many other books, Blackbirds, Blue Blazes. He's got lots going on.
He's got a comic book.
I forgot about that. Tell us about the comic book before we tell us a little bit of what you can tell people about.
Archie is relaunching the old Red Circle superheroes in the form of Dark Circle Comics. And one of the superheroes they are relaunching and rebooting is a superhero called The Shield. It's kind of the patriotic character that predates Captain America. It was originally a sort of rah-rah dude named Joe Higgins, and me and author Adam Christopher are rebooting him as a her. And so we're really excited about the direction that we're getting to take it. We actually kind of came at him with a slightly conservative reboot of the character, and they're like, no, we want you to go bigger and weirder. And, you know, so it was like, can we gender flip? Can we do some more unusual things with this character? And so they were very excited about that, and so that was a nice opportunity for us to do some cool stuff that still ties into, you know, some sort of loose, light fan service for people who actually know what Red Circle Comics is. But by no means are we forced to adhere to any of that, and we're telling stories for a new generation of readers.
That's awesome. Is there a release date on that yet?
2015. There will be a New York City Comic Con 3-5 page preview that we're writing.
Awesome.
But
And yeah. since you are kind of going back in time, you know, to kind of pull material, are you also going to reinstitute the Comics Code Authority and live by that? And
we are actually going pre-Comics Code Authority.
Oh, okay.
Riding that into the curb. Bye bye, Comics Code. Screw you. Yeah.
John has no idea what I'm talking about.
No, I know a little bit about Chicago. But anyway, that is awesome. I'm looking forward to that. And anything else you want to tell our listeners about before we wrap it up, John?
No, I think we're in good shape.
Any con appearances coming up?
I'm doing the Surrey Writers Conference nice. In October. So it'll be a good time outside of Vancouver.
Vancouver. Okay, very good. So if you're in that area, go and check Chuck out there. Patrick, what do you got going on this week?
Well, I would just go throw it out there. If anyone would like to hear the panel, the only time I've ever actually moderated Chuck on a panel, still get that over on SF Signal. So I'm assuming that's what inspired the post in the first place, because that's the only time I've ever moderated you. So, Kirkus, I've got my stuff over there. Which I do comic book stuff. So hopefully when Chuck and Adam have a graphic novel collection ready, I can get a hold of it and put it up over on Kirkus.
Sold.
And we did Amazon versus Hachette on SF Signal. Chuck was invited, but he conveniently lost power. Yeah, yeah.
Probably for the best.
Like, I believe that. And again, we had the Epic Fantasy one that I'm really kind of pushing here lately, because it was just so much fun to have Tad Williams and Kate Elliott, who were two authors who really influenced me. And, you know, they had some great, great Epic Fantasy before you had things like Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time or George R. R. Martin and all that kind of stuff. So just to have them on there and talking was a lot of fun. So I encourage people to go listen to that.
Sweet, sweet. For me this week, just check out my music over at johnanilio.com. Follow me on Twitter at johnanilio. Alrighty, everybody, have a great week, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks, guys.
Smoke. I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.